Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello, my guest today is John K. Locke, an attorney, historian, and senior advisor and counsel to South Dakota Senator John Thune. John Locke has authored several books on Midwestern political and economic history, but today he'll be discussing The Lost Region Toward a Revival of Midwestern History, as well as his most recent office, president of the Midwestern History Association. John, you have written a book. I mean, first, thank you very much for joining us and discussing this topic.
Thank you, Albert.
I was struck by many things, by your book and by the recent session that you arranged at the Organization of American History annual conference. But let me quote you to yourself first. Which is a favorite sensation for most academics, I have to say. It's autoeroticism for many of us. You write, "To end the neglect of their region, Midwestern historians will need to explain why the Midwest matters to the broader course of American history." Let's start with that as our jumping off point. First of all, is the Midwest neglected? And how?
Well, first of all, thank you, Albert, for taking the time to talk about this. I really appreciate it, and it was great to meet you down in St. Louis, and I'm glad we've connected on this topic. And yes, the Midwest does matter. In fact, one of the beginnings of this book was an article I wrote for a journal entitled "Why the Midwest Matters," and we had a nice discussion about that, several people who weighed in on it, and it was a good beginning, a good way to broach this entire topic. But you really can't understand the United States unless you study and understand the Midwest and include it in your outlines when you're teaching the history of this nation. I mean, it was a central issue in the first global war, also known as the French and Indian War, which ended up precipitating the American Revolution. And there were a lot of machinations during the American Revolution about what would happen to what they then called the West, but what we now call the Midwest. This is a major issue, but it gets neglected because people tend to focus on George Washington and the Eastern Seaboard and what was happening in Imperial London. But what was happening in the backcountry was also very important. And it was one of the precipitating causes of the revolution. People forget about all the frictions that there were between the colonials and the British when it came to what we would now call the Midwest. And of course, over a longer course of time, the settlement of the Midwest and its industrial development and its urbanization and its role in American life today, these are major elements of American life, but they just don't get very much focus by American historians. And that's what I lay out in a lot of detail in my book, The Lost Region.
You quote, I believe, H.L. Mencken said it, saying of Willa Cather, "I don't care how well she writes, I don't give a damn what happens in Nebraska," which could have been written about Ted Kooser or last week, I guess, or 10 years ago when he was poet laureate.
Right. No, it's very true. It's a very common attitude among the people that pull the levers of our cultural institutions, which tend to be located on the coasts, especially in New York and Boston. And H.L. Mencken, of course, was in Baltimore, but he spent a lot of time in New York, and his attitude was very common and remains very common to this day. I was on a panel this weekend at the Center for Western Studies at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, not your Augustana College down in the Quad Cities. But there was a young man there who publishes literature from the Midwest, and he has a book that comes out every year, News Stories from the Midwest. And he said he was just at a literary conference, and a New York publisher came by his booth and looked sort of quizzically at him and said to him, without an introduction or any sort of preliminary niceties, said to him, "Why do I want to read stories about corn? I don't care about corn." Yeah. And I think that sort of encapsulates this problem. There's also, since we're talking about literature, there's a new journal that just started this year called Flyover Country Review. And I think that sort of captures the problem, too. I mean, it's this part of the country is seen by many people as flyover country, as unimportant, as not important to the unfolding of the American story. And so we're trying to tap into that sense of neglect, and not just that sense of neglect, that actual neglect. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to do something about it.
How did this endeavor come to be? And this whole, what's now become, I mean, you've done an amazing job. Your social media guy is a graduate student at Iowa State, I believe. This entire endeavor has really been meticulously rolled out. But when we were discussing in the pre-podcast discussion, you were telling me a little bit about how it came to be, and it was a little bit more random and spontaneous than I had thought.
It has very specific origins, and it was not entirely planned by any means. I had been asked sometime in, I don't know, 2003 or 2004, I was not asked. I was told by the chair of my department at the time at South Dakota University, about a month before classes were to begin, I was told, "Oh, by the way, you need to teach the history of South Dakota this fall."
Jeez, that was
because late. It's an important class for people who become teachers.
Yeah.
So I went about doing this, and in the course of it, I found the story of the settlement of Dakota Territory very compelling and ended up writing a book about it entitled Prairie Republic. But one of the things I noticed about the settlement of Dakota Territory is that 85% of the American settlers. Now, I'm talking about people who moved into Dakota from within the United States, as opposed to Norwegian immigrants or German immigrants or whatever.
Those would be my great grandparents moved to Dakota directly from Germany. Well, maybe a brief stop.
Really?
Yeah, a brief stop in Nebraska, maybe.
Yes, well, that was very common. I mean, Nebraska, the Dakotas, they're very heavily German, a lot of German immigrants. But I'm talking about the people who moved from inside the United States. 85% of them who moved to Dakota Territory moved from the Midwest, and they moved from Illinois and Wisconsin and Ohio. Those were particularly strong states for settlers. And so after I finished the book and finished the manuscript and it came out as a book in 2010, I just thought I would do one quick follow-up article to that and say something about what it means that all these settlers in Dakota Territory were Midwestern. Mm-hmm. And how did that influence the institutional makeup of the state and the culture of the state? And I thought this would not be a complex project. But when I started to try and read up on the basic story of the Midwest so I could make some general conclusions, I started to notice that there really was very little written about the Midwest in recent decades. And after some more digging, I discovered that early in the 20th century, there once was a very vibrant and active field of Midwestern history. And it actually was the precursor to the Organization of American Historians. And I found this to be a fascinating story about how these historians in Iowa and Minnesota, Nebraska, Illinois, all came together in 1907 in a meeting in Lincoln, Nebraska, and formed a new historical society called the Mississippi Valley Historical Association because they were tired of being neglected by the broader institutions of professional historians in the United States, and they were ignored in particular by the American Historical Association. So they began their own organization. I found this to be a fascinating story, and anyway, I kind of dropped my article about the Midwesterners who moved into Dakota Territory and started studying this phenomena of Midwestern history, why it was once strong and why it fell apart. And ultimately, this becomes my book, The Lost Region. Mm-hmm. And because the book was going to come out in the fall of 2013, we organized a little panel for the fall of 2013 at the Northern Great Plains History Conference, where some people would come together and offer their thoughts on the field of Midwestern history and why it had languished in recent decades. And that was supposed to correspond with the launch of the book that fall. Well, about a month or two before the conference was to begin, I sent an email to the people who attend the conference. And this year it happened to, or in that year it happened to be in Wisconsin, so it was kind of a perfect setting for this book. And by the way, we had to meet at the Northern Great Plains History Conference because there was no history conference that focused on the Midwest.
Right.
And so we ended up at the Northern Great Plains Conference. I sent an email to people saying, yeah, this is kind of an interesting topic. We're going to have a panel about it at the conference in October. If anybody wants to talk about this more, let's meet in the bar at 5 o'clock on Friday of the conference. And I did not know how many people would show up. I figured a couple of my friends would show up who I've sort of talked about this in the past with. But it turns out 35 people showed up. And when that happened, you know, it sort of turned on the light bulb. Like there's something bigger going on here. There's a greater desire out there than maybe we thought to do something about the lack of Midwestern history. Hmm. And several people who have taught in the Midwest for 30 or 40 years sort of weighed in on their experiences with this and their frustration with the fact that they had nowhere to publish their work. I mean, you could publish in journals on the Great Plains, mm-hmm. or you could publish in journals about the South or on the West, but that you know, and the West at one point kind of included the Midwest, but they've kind of lost that focus, and they're kind of focused on the Trans-Missouri River West mostly now.
Yeah.
And so people writing about the Midwest or who wanted to write about the Midwest were essentially homeless. And so we began to talk about how could we change this, and could we start a journal for so people would have a place to send their work? And pretty soon we had declared the beginning of the Midwestern History Working Group, which we decided would meet for the following year and have some panels at other conferences and reach out to other people and, you know, start a Facebook page and just see if there, take the temperature of other people in the region and see if there was an interest in something bigger. And that turned out to be very successful. And we had meetings in Omaha and at the Western History Association and a few other conferences. And, you know, we sort of decided we were at critical mass and there was a lot of interest in this. So we had a meeting a year after that first meeting and declared the beginning of the Midwestern History Association. And we formally went through the process of adopting bylaws and electing officers and choosing some prizes that we would award every year for good work in Midwestern history. And so it's taken off very quickly, and I think that speaks to the fact that there are a lot of people out there who do recognize on a second look the neglect of the Midwest as a field of study.
You, in the end of the book, you suggest of various means that could be undertaken to revive Midwestern history, including setting up an association again. You also suggest someone going to Warren Buffett and asking him for a large check. I don't know if that's happened yet, but good luck with that.
I have not been put on Warren Buffett's calendar yet, but maybe he'll hear this broadcast and express some interest.
Yeah, he won't, but but maybe someone who does can give generously in the interest of Midwestern filial pietism. But I want to make it clear that this is not a filial pietistic. I mean, some people have taken this. I mean, I think Michael Derda, of all people, in the Washington Post, turns out to be a proud Midwesterner. And there's a way in which he was he commented this as really he was raising his own flag of regional pride. I have to be clear, this is not merely a flag of regional pride. It's not that you, John Locke, and many other people as part of this project don't have regional pride. You have tons of it. But you're also doing this because you think the Midwest is important, not only in American history, but actually in world history. I should emphasize that.
Yes, I absolutely. I mean, if people are drawn to this organization through some form of regional pride, that's great. But our goal with the Midwestern History Association is to generate more substantive scholarly work on the history of the region. And, you know, that includes the good and the bad. And the fact that the Midwest has a lot to be proud of should not inhibit study of the region. But I do think it has something to do with the fact that there's little study of the region because, let's face it, historians are drawn to drama and conflict and wars and tyrannies. And when there's a minimal amount of that, this story becomes somewhat boring.
Wow.
I mean, we all know this problem. Any of us who have taught in a history department know that the course offered in the history of Nazi Germany will fill up in 10 seconds.
Yeah, almost as good as the history of the Pacific War, which is one of my colleagues is teaching right now, which is packed.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, then that's because it's a big, grand, very interesting, compelling story.
Yeah.
And has a major impact on world history. And the students have some familiarity with it, just because, you know, they flip through the channels and they see the History Channel once in a while, which is half about World War II, which is great. I mean, that's what they're interested in. But when you have a subject that isn't as dramatic, it's a little more difficult to draw an interest. Now, I would add that I think there's a perception that it's non-dramatic. I do think there are a lot of important stories to tell in the Midwest. I mean, the beginnings of the Midwest in this big clash of global empires between the French and the British and the Spanish, and how the Midwest was sort of carved out of all these imperial struggles, not just by European imperial powers, but by Native American powers in the region, who are always waxing and waning and having battles and switching sides and switching alliances. It's a very interesting story.
Absolutely. If you don't see the Dakota as an imperial power, then your definition of imperial power is different than mine.
Right.
And Tecumseh is another figure in that, who's also has that drama and appeal.
You know, I was, you mentioned Michael Derda. Michael Derda is the Washington Post book review editor who happens to be from the little town of Lorain, Ohio. And he wrote a great book that not many people know about it, about growing up in Lorain and what that means. But as Michael was quick to point out to me at a conference in recent years, don't forget that Toni Morrison comes from Lorain, Ohio. And she was on public radio last week talking about her new book and reflecting on growing up in Lorain. And she mentioned the fact that when she grew up in Lorain, there was no official segregation or even semi-official segregation. Everybody went to the same school. And she described that phenomena of all these different peoples that came together in Lorain, Ohio, including Eastern Europeans and what you would call, or what people used to call, old stock Americans, and then African-American families from the South. And she talked about her father, who had grown up in Georgia, and how much racial prejudice he had faced in the South. And she was making regional distinctions. Mm-hmm. She was talking about how much different the Midwest was from the South. Yeah. And she was talking about how the racial experiences in the United States were so dramatically different. And, you know, it caused me to think about, this is an important angle on Midwestern history that people tend not to think about.
Yeah. And then the fact that there, you know, are lynchings in the Midwest is interesting, that that's occurring side by side. You know, when I taught in Indiana, one of the most famous lynching photographs occurs in Marion, Indiana, I believe.
Right.
And that's not that far away from Lorain.
Well, I think there are some really interesting intra-Midwestern stories to tell.
Yeah, exactly.
Indiana, that you mentioned, was very heavily Southern. It's the most Southern of the Midwestern states. And what I mean by that is it was settled predominantly by Southerners. As opposed to a place like Minnesota, which was primarily settled by Yankees from the North and all these immigrant Norwegians and Germans, et cetera. So you see in this most recent history of lynching in the United States, they tally the numbers. And if you look at Indiana between like 1880 and 1930 or something like that, there were about 25 lynchings. In Minnesota, there was one. Now, and I think that really represents some very interesting intra-regional variety or complexity or diversity. Yeah. I mean, there are different places in the Midwest made up of different people that have create a different kind of political culture. And all that can be explored under the rubric of Midwestern history. It's not just one giant, bland, monochromatic blob of white people. It's a very interesting and complex place. Yeah. In fact, it's the most diverse place in the United States for most of its history, given all of its different immigrant groups and the great migration of blacks from the South, et cetera. But people don't realize that.
No, and just to, even the diversity becomes more complex when you realize that you cite this figure in your book, that Indiana sent 57% of its military age men to join the Union Army. So this is the most Southern state in the Midwest, and yet has really an extraordinary enlistment rate that begins to start to approach some of the lower Confederate states in terms of enlistment. So it's really complex, and it's really diverse.
Yes. Yeah, and I think one of the goals of the Midwestern History Association is to embrace that complexity and try and get it across to the world a little bit about how many different and varying and diverse stories there are to tell from this region.
Let's talk about the men you refer to as the prairie historians for just a little bit. You touched on them earlier. They had started the Mississippi Valley Historical Association, right? That was the precursor of the Organization of American History. Why did they choose the name Mississippi Valley?
Well, the giant drainage basin known as the Mississippi Valley, which would include, you know, these important tributaries, the Ohio River and the Missouri River. This makes up the central place that these historians wanted to study, mm-hmm. and that they thought was being neglected by historians in the East. And they recognized that people in the South had their own set of cultural and heritage and historical institutions. So they, you know, readily noted that no one was studying our region. So they had a meeting in Lincoln, Nebraska, hosted by the Nebraska Historical Society, and representatives came from the 12 states in the Midwest, or what we traditionally define as the Midwest. And in 1907, they planted their flag. They said, we're starting the Mississippi Valley Historical Association to cover this inland region, which was being neglected. And about 7 years later, they launched their own journal, which became the Mississippi Valley Historical Review. And it became a very prominent organization. And in the beginning, they tended to focus on their region and publish articles about their region. 80%+ of the articles in the journal in the early years were about the region. And then, it grew quite dramatically, and a lot of historians joined. And after World War II, there were so many historians in it from around the country in various places that there was a movement started to nationalize the organization and make it a national institution focused on all of American history. And in the 1960s, that happened, and it changed its name to the Organization of American Historians, which is where we met last week in St. Louis at their annual convention. And they changed the name of the journal from the Mississippi Valley Historical Review to the Journal of American History. Now, there's a lot of good things associated with that, of course, and we need an umbrella organization for American history, but it created a major problem for Midwesterners, because it left them without a place to focus their energies and a place to publish their articles about the region. And, you know, as a practicing historian, you know how this works. It's very, it's a big commitment to take on a research project when there are lots of places to publish your work. When there's not an obvious place to publish your work, it's a major deterrent to taking on a project. So this contributes to the decline in the activity in the field. And then, you know, there were some auxiliary institutions and journals that existed over the years. There was a journal in Western Illinois. There was one called Upper Midwest History. There was one called the Old Northwest Historical Review that came out of Ohio, and a few others. But they have all died. All of them went under in the last 20 years or so. So prior to, until about a year ago, well, actually, till last fall, there was no journal that focused on the history of the Midwest. And so there was no obvious place to send this sort of work. And as a result, the field suffered.
But it seems to me that this is, what I see happening in the field broadly is a lot of people are pushing against what were conventional boundaries. And the regional boundaries, well, I'm a Southern historian, or I'm supposed to be. And even in the history of the American South, which you'd think is pretty well defined, and we could argue about where the South is Texas part of the South, blah, blah, blah. But Nevertheless, you see at the Southern Historical Association, we have lots and lots of, well, it seems we have numerous sessions now in the Caribbean or on Latin America. Their people are very uncomfortable with regional boundaries. They're uncomfortable with national boundaries. I think the most prominent book discussing the direction of, say, the American History Survey in the last 10 or 15 years was, I think, the U.S. and the World. United States and the world, basically arguing that even the way that we teach United States history must be connected to world history, much to teach the United States in amongst the rest of the nations. In my other, as an early American historian, I mean, I've been born and raised amongst the idea of Atlantic history. No one really knows what Atlantic history is, but everyone sure talks about it. Yeah, I heard Jack Green say that. So if anyone has a problem with that, please direct your emails to Jack Green, Professor Emeritus of History at Johns Hopkins University. So I think that it's amazing to me that 35 people did show up at a bar in a regional history conference, given the fact that there are seem to be so many forces militating against that.
Well, I think when I start my course on the history of the Midwest, I immediately begin with the international context of the Midwest. And this is a great exercise, not simply in getting people to think about the Midwest, which I think is a good thing to do when you're offering a class like this in the region itself, but you can start with an exercise in international history. And so I think we can kill two birds with one stone in a lot of this, because if you properly begin your history of the Midwest, you begin with Atlantic history. You begin with these imperial histories. Again, not just Spain and France and Great Britain, but also the imperial Indian tribes in the Midwest. And so you can begin with a very compelling story of international history and connecting the United States to global history. And that's very easily done. But at the same time, you can also drill down on local history, and you can help students understand their roots and where they come from and how to orient themselves in the world. I mean, I've always been of the opinion that, we should have studies of the world and global studies and multiculturalism, et cetera. But you really can't do that very effectively unless people know who they are, unless they understand their own identity and they understand their own place in the world, because then they have something to compare that to. It gives them a context for understanding other places and cultures. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of kids who go to college in the Midwest, they don't have a class in Midwestern history and grounding themselves in a particular place where they're from. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think they're going to be stronger individuals, they're going to be stronger students, they're going to be stronger citizens of this republic if they have some better sense of their identity, and they're not always bombarded with these messages from the dominant media about, well, you're nobody, you're from out in flyover country, nobody cares about you. You know, they learn the H.L. Mencken attitude pretty quickly, and that's not helpful to one's development, I don't think, especially when there is such a interesting history available to be taught. Unfortunately, we haven't done a very good job in our region of keeping these kind of regional historical institutions alive. Here's a good example for you, Albert. At the University of Georgia, since you're a Southern historian, you'll appreciate this. University of Georgia, they have 10 people who teach the history of the South and the history of Georgia.
Yeah.
Because, you know, regional consciousness is just stronger in the South. At the University of Minnesota, which is an even bigger institution, a major institution with like 50-plus people in the history department, they have 0 people who teach the history of the Midwest.
Well, isn't that just Minnesota? I mean, they're just embarrassed. They're just embarrassed to have people focus on them. It would just be embarrassing. I mean, I think maybe it was someone else at the session suggested that Midwesterners just don't like to talk about themselves. Southerners, that's the beginning of either a party, a wedding, or a fight. I mean, that's. But no, come on, Midwest. Just, you know, please, let's talk about African history. They'd rather talk about African history.
Right. Well, I do think that there is a sense that, gosh, we don't have much to talk about here.
Yeah.
We don't have much of a history. You know, why do we want to spend time on that? But once you get people thinking about it just a little bit, just a little primer, they realize, well, there is a very compelling story here to be told. And I think they begin to want to peel back the onion a little bit then. And that's what a simple class in the history of the Midwest can do. And, you know, I want to emphasize at the beginning of this whole process that we're not asking for the world at the Midwestern History Association. We just want a few classes to be taught on the history of the American Midwest, especially at some prominent Midwestern universities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that could be tacked on to existing areas of emphasis. So, you know, a historian of the American West could learn to do this, or colonial historians could potentially learn to do this. Hey, I mean, it would be great if they brought on full professors to focus on Midwestern studies. That'd be wonderful. But, you know, we want to be reasonable about it, and we know that's not always going to happen. But it's a class that should be offered once every couple of years at every serious university in the Midwest, I think.
Yeah, I think if Southerners can do it, Midwesterners can do it. I'm teaching Illinois history right now, which I have to admit I did because I wanted to teach future high school history teachers. But I am actually starting to find I'm starting to find Midwestern history, sort of calm, tranquil, and oddly compelling. It's a break from Southern history, the Sturm und Drang, as they call it in Alabama.
Right. Well, I think, Albert, another possible solution to all of this is to have people who teach state-based histories, such as yourself, just broaden the course a little bit so that the course is Illinois and the Midwest.
Yeah.
And I know of someone who is teaching a class called Iowa and the Midwest. So you can give it a little bit of local emphasis, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
Give the state you're in a little more emphasis. But also give them the whole context of the region. Because, you know, these states, they're not self-contained entities. They're all affected by where they are in space,
yeah,
and in their region. And, you know, some places are going to be more heavily oriented, like Missouri, for example. Essentially, the southern half of Missouri is basically southern.
Yes.
And the northern half is a different breed of cats there. It's a different form of settlement. There's no slavery. I mean, this is why there's so much clash in, yeah, Missouri during the Civil War. There's an explanation for this sort of thing. But
yeah.
We need to be creative.
As I realized again that during the OAH meeting, and St. Louis is a very different kind of river town than, say, well, Davenport, obviously. The racial story there is very different. It's a meeting of two cultures.
Right.
As we're finishing up, where do you go from here?
Our immediate goal is to continue to get people thinking about this field and sort of broaden out our base and hopefully bring some more people into the fold. We've got some ideas. Our crack communications team at the Midwestern History Association, which is mostly younger scholars and graduate students who are very savvy about social media. They have some good ideas for reaching out to more historians. More immediately, we're going to have the first ever, as far as I am aware of, the first ever conference completely focused on the history of the Midwest. Later this week in Grand Rapids, Michigan, it's going to be at Grand Valley State University, hosted by the Hauenstein Center. And we are going to have about 15 scholars come in and speak about this field. We have some excellent presenters, including the president of the OAH, John Butler. And he's been very supportive of it. So we have a nice alliance there with some of the folks at the OAH. But we hope that this conference will lead to a volume of essays about how to go forward with studies of Midwestern history. Our next meeting is going to be next year in conjunction with the Western History Association because, well, it's a great place to bring in lots of other scholars, and because we believe, and I think a lot of historians would agree with this, we all don't need another meeting to go to. So if we can double up, that's very helpful. And the Western will be in St. Paul, Minnesota in 2016, so that's a great location for us. And the president of the Western has asked me to be on the program committee and scout out topics that are obviously Midwestern. And so, and I think this is an important matter for the people in the Western History Association because they are beginning to realize that they have basically neglected the eastern side of the Missouri, and you know, I think they want to pay some attention to that. And I think the organization, our organization, and the fact that we have nearly 600 members so far, wow, I think that sent a strong signal to them that they need to pay attention to this. So we're going to do that, and then we are planning our meeting for 2017 already. We're going to do it in conjunction with the Agricultural History Society. They reached out to us about having a combined meeting. The Ag History Society used to be very heavily Midwestern, was located at Ames, Iowa, and in Fargo for many, many years. But in more recent years, it's become a lot more international and broader and less Midwestern. But they want to kind of return to their roots in 2017 for a meeting, and we're looking forward to working with them on that. But we hope more fundamentally and more long-term to work with more graduate students and just get some more books focused on the Midwest and get kind of a corpus of key works out there about the region that are self-consciously regional, mm-hmm, meaning that they aren't just topics that happen to take place in the Midwest, but they take into account what it means that these historical events took place in the Midwest as opposed to Texas or California.
Well, this has been great. I'm looking forward to having other conversations with you and members of the Midwestern History Association in the future. The book, for those of you who want to read about Midwestern history, and for those of you who don't, is The Lost Region, Toward a Revival of Midwestern History. And my guest has been John Locke. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Albert, and continue to spread the word down there in the Quad Cities.
Okay. For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.